This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. A group of attorneys, activists, and average citizens are speaking out against race-based human rights violations in North Carolina. Last month, a conference in Greensboro brought together more than 70 people to consider instances of racial profiling, police brutality, and extraordinary rendition. They were asked to create a vocal opposition to what they call abuses of state power. Conference organizer Lewis Pitts is the managing attorney with Advocates for Children's Services at Legal Aid of North Carolina. He invited Flint Taylor, a longtime lawyer in Chicago, to be a keynote speaker. Now, this was not Flint's first time in Greensboro. He was part of the legal team that litigated the landmark case there against the Ku Klux Klan and neo-Nazis in 1985. On today's show, we're going to talk about how some historic cases of civil and human rights violations have played out in the legal system, and then talk about how far there is yet to go in creating a truly fair criminal justice system. Attorneys Lewis Pitts and Flint Taylor are my guests this hour. Welcome to both of you. Good to have you on the program.
Great to be here.
Hello, Flint.
Hello. Nice to be with you.
Lewis, let me talk with you first about the conference itself. What was the idea behind the conference?
Well, in community conversations and friendships across the state, I think many folks were realizing that there was a serious problem in the big picture standpoint. If we start with our school systems, we're seeing what's called the school-to-prison pipeline, children pushed out of school and into prison. If we get into the adult world, we're looking at mass incarcerations, our nation being the worst in the world. And then we move on to another issue we probably will talk about today. We have our government involved in torture and literally assassination. So we were somewhat under the umbrella of worrying and concerned about the collapse of rule of law, the very basic principle that every person is subject to the law and should be held accountable, particularly in what we purport to have, which is a self-governing democracy. So that, I think, really was the impetus for our gathering in Greensboro.
Of course, cases like this have come up from time to time. We have the feeling sometimes that it's all in the past, but there are some important historic cases. Flint, you were part of the legal team that represented the plaintiffs in the civil suit against the Greensboro Ku Klux Klan in 1985. Remind us about that case, will you?
Yes, and not only was I, but of course Lewis Pitts was as well, and we fought that case for many years, and of course it was an assassination and murder that happened on the streets of Greensboro that we found out was not only foisted by the Klan and the Nazis, but also with police cooperation and cooperation by FBI and ATF informants. And it was a very important case in the South for many years, and it built on other cases of assassination and official murder, such as that I had been involved in the past, such as the murder of Black Panther leaders Fred Hampton and Mark Clark in Chicago in 1969. And later, I've been involved in the last quarter century in fighting against police torture here in the city of Chicago. So there's a line you can draw across the country. Not only across the country, but through these outrageous cases of torture and brutality and assassination. And that's one of the reasons that Lewis asked me to come down and speak to the conference, was to draw those parallels and to bring them into the present and try to learn from the experiences that we all went through in fighting these cases, both as lawyers and, of course, the activists that supported us and made it all possible to gain victories in these cases.
Well, and tell us about the outcome of the Greensboro case, the Klan case.
Well, the Klan case, there were three trials. First, the Klan was indicted, and some of the Nazis were indicted by the state authorities very reluctantly for murder, and it was kind of a lay-down case. It was a all-white jury and acquitted the Klansmen, even though they were on a videotape as having pulled out their guns and shot down the anti-Klan demonstrators in cold blood. The feds then came in under the Reagan administration and did a somewhat half-hearted civil rights prosecution. That, too, ended unfavorably for the victims, as the Klansmen and Nazis were acquitted of conspiracy by another all-white Southern jury. In the civil rights case, which is what Lewis and I and many other lawyers and legal workers fought for several years, it was about was brought for damages. And in that case, we were actually able to win a verdict. We had a very strong African-American man on our jury, and we were able to get liability against some of the Klansmen and some of the Nazis and some of the police for conspiracy to murder and to maim the demonstrators. And so that was a significant victory in the history of the fight against the Klan and Nazis and police cooperation in the South back in the actual the assassination and murders took place in 79, and the verdict was in 1985.
So that's a verdict in 85, but it took place, as you said, 79. Then in 1969, 10 years earlier, that was those were the murders of Fred Hampton and Mark Clark. And again, remind us of those cases, because there's a path here. 69, 79, you think it's over, and it keeps going. But Fred Hampton and Mark Clark.
Well, Fred Hampton was a very young and very powerful and dynamic Black Panther leader here in the city. In the early morning of December 4th, 1969, a squadron of police under the control of the state's attorney of Cook County, Edward Hanrahan, came to their apartment while they were sleeping, that is Fred Hampton and Mark Clark's, and they went in and fired about 100 bullets from shotguns and machine guns, and they went into Hampton's bedroom while he had been drugged and in bed. He'd been drugged by a police provocateur informant, and they murdered him in cold blood. Of course, they covered all of this up for many years, and we fought the case in like we did in Greensboro in a civil case, and through the civil case we found out that not only was it a police murder, but we discovered and proved that it was set up by the FBI's COINTELPRO program. Hoover had an infamous program to destroy Black nationalist and progressive organizations. It went for decades, and it culminated in his program to destroy the Black Panther Party. And what we found was this FBI informant provocateur, William O'Neill, under the control of the COINTELPRO program, set up this entire raid, and it was designed as part of the program to wipe out the Black Panthers. That took us 13 years to actually establish that, but we did ultimately win that case and, more significantly, change public opinion and history about what went on during that raid and its aftermath.
Senate hearings followed. There were reforms in the FBI that all followed COINTELPRO, the revelation of COINTELPRO and its involvement in this and many other cases. So that's 69, 79, and we're thinking, okay, we've discovered all this. We've had the Senate hearings. No more of that. Now, right now in Greensboro, the case of Jorge Cornell, who is a member of the Latin Kings that the Greensboro police will call a gang, and he's been arrested. He has a criminal record, right, and he's in jail. So tell us a little about his case, Lewis Pitts.
Well, Jorge was indicted this past December by the federal government on charges of racketeering influence and corrupt organization, and along with other people. To understand the case, and it, I have to do it very quickly here, we need to go back to 2008, when Jorge, as leader of this group of Latino folks, came to African-American ministers. They began to have meetings. They talked about the importance of ending this sort of gang strife and fighting and illegality. And literally, they said, we need to come together to fight economic and racial oppression. That was June of 08. The next month, in July, he started receiving almost daily harassments, provocations from the Greensboro Gang Squad. That extended incredibly. He's been charged with at least 18 felonies, no convictions for those. So wrongful charges, the disruption of life, the having to go through bail, lose jobs, etc. It was so bad, not only for folks like Jorge, but within the Greensboro Police Department, African-American and Latino officers were beginning to complain about the way they were treated and what they were seeing from the treatment by the gang squad. And they began to complain and file complaints. So ultimately, by 2010, a group of 37 or more citizens, ministers from Greensboro, made a trip to Washington, D.C. to meet with the Justice Department and file what's called a Title VI complaint about the racism. That's the backdrop. rather than proceeding with the investigation and the cleaning up of these allegations. The next step is the federal government comes over the top of that with indictments that read, I read the indictment, it's some 30-plus pages. It would scare you to death to read the allegations. Now, Jorge has been in jail since that December of 2011, no bond. There's no question that there are people that he had been around who had been part of the Latin Kings and Queens that engaged in illegal conduct. And they're the ones being pinched and leaned on by the federal authorities because they're looking at decades in jail. Or they can make a deal, make statements against Jorge. We don't know the outcome. There's been no trial. But it reeks of this same phenomenon that Flint has been talking about, where if you're politically active and you want to complain about racism and class, that the repressive forces of state and federal government are brought down on you.
And he ran for city council in 2010.
Exactly right. He actually ran to be engaged civically as the way we are supposed to in our nation. And I think there was retaliation for that very act.
Our conversation on the state of things continues. My guest, attorneys Lewis Pitts of Legal Aid North Carolina, Flint Taylor of the People's Law Office in Chicago, both of them part of a conference in Greensboro last month considering race-based human rights violations. Just ahead, we're going to talk about the role of citizens in fixing the criminal justice system, also rendition and torture on the part of the United States of America. You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. More than 35,000 people will be arrested in America by the end of this day. Most of them will be racial minorities. Many will join a population of 2 million incarcerated in our nation's prison system. My guest on the show today is just one example of how our legal system promotes race-based human rights violations. It came together in April for a conference in Greensboro, organized by attorney Lewis Pitts. Chicago civil rights lawyer Flint Taylor was the keynote speaker. We've been talking with them about historic cases of police and prosecutorial misconduct. Joining the conversation now is James P. Mays. He's the director of criminal justice program at North Carolina A&T State University in Greensboro. James, welcome to the program. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
Also with us is Christina Cowger. She is a professor of plant pathology at North Carolina State University in Raleigh, but she's also a longtime volunteer with the NC Stop Torture Now group. And hello, Christina. Welcome to the program.
Thanks very much.
Good to have you here. So, James Mays, you have a career studying how political power gets distributed and how the legal system, you know, sort of works as part of that. And how do these cases stack up? Is there a kind of pattern that emerges when you hear these cases, just the ones in North Carolina?
Certainly there is a pattern. And we've seen this over a long period of history. We know that political power, and in this particular case, the power of the judiciary, police power, power that's vested in the executive to punish or hold people accountable, that these things often are used to, if you will, tamp down any type of unrest or vocal protest against the system. And so what we find now that there has been an adverse impact of the criminal justice system on, if you want to call it a system, on certain segments of the population. If we talk about minorities, if we talk about, in particular, women who enter the system, we can look at children. Children at greater numbers are being criminalized, their acts being criminalized. And so there are many things that need to be fixed. But underlying all of this is this continual disrespect for civil liberties and also for human rights. And these things must be addressed.
We talked about the case of Jorge Cornell in Greensboro right now. Well, you said there are parallels between that and the Black Panthers.
Oh, absolutely. Today, there's a bit of revisionism going on. If you look at a lot of the government literature, they define the Black Panther Party as a terrorist group. And I remind people that the title of the group, group. The name of their group was the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense. And they not only you know, said that people have a right to defend themselves against police violence, but they were involved in after-school programs, free breakfast programs, a variety of things to help people in their various areas of need. And so what we see today is that the situation of Jorge is similar because he has a connection to a criminal past. Many of the Black Panthers also, and this connection to their criminal past was a liability, and the government was able to capitalize
on this. But the fact is, this is criminal. Some Black Panthers were involved in criminal activity, things that broke the law. Some Latin Kings involved in criminal activity. The police have to respond to that, don't they?
Absolutely. But what we also need to acknowledge is that many of these people, if we begin to mention people like Bobby Seale or, you know, Eldridge Cleaver, Catherine Cleaver, et cetera, they had a change in their personal and political consciousness. And once they made that change and they say, I'm no longer going to be a threat to my community, I'm going to be a help, a shield, if you will, against the things that the average citizen has to confront. And so they made a decision. And when people make those decisions, like Jorge, right, we should not criminalize the choice to be a freedom fighter versus someone who's engaged in crime.
Flint Taylor, this becomes the ultimate threat, doesn't it? It's a group of people who are perhaps poor, but they begin to organize first to provide themselves with the basic necessities that the state and the city are failing to provide, breakfast programs, recreation programs, and secondly, develop a political consciousness, and they're organized. This becomes the ultimate threat, Flint Taylor?
Absolutely, and you can draw the parallels back to the Panthers, because the Panthers in Chicago particularly were organizing to bring the young lords and the Patriots and other organizations together in the original Rainbow Coalition, and they were also trying to organize street gangs, big African-American street gangs, into changing their consciousness and changing their attitudes about preying on their own communities, and instead joining in a progressive outlook and in a coalition. And when that happened, the federal government, through its COINTELPRO program, tried to break that up. And they did some amazing things here in the city, trying to turn the leadership of the Blackstone Rangers, the African-American gang, against the leadership of Fred Hampton, and tried to create a war. And literally, in their own racist way, were trying to foment violence between the Panthers and the Blackstone Rangers when, in fact, the Panthers were trying to bring them out of the kind of violence that they were perpetrating in their own community. So the government sees a bigger threat, obviously, when a Jorge or a Fred Hampton or another leader turns and tries to change the attitudes of the oppressed people who are in street gangs to deal with politically rather than against their own people.
And the city you're talking about, of course, is Chicago, and all of the evidence that points to that has been all of it unfolded in the hearings that followed. So, Lewis Pitts, in Greensboro today, you talked about attempts to reconcile differences among Latin community and African-American communities through the churches. What does that look like today? Is there a coalition, and is there action on the ground that looks like the kind of thing we're talking about, a kind of rapprochement between the groups?
Well, I won't say that nothing like that is happening, but there are times when this oppression and repression is successful, that the efforts of the around-the-table meetings in the churches of Reverend Nelson Johnson and others to collaborate together to stop this violence. That was an ongoing thing, the write-up of a promise and a pledge to proceed. I'm not sure that that's happening right now. I know the ministers are still supportive. There's still the desire to do this. But at some point, people's energies are forced to be diverted into defending these charges and providing economic survival. How do you find a job? So Flynn has mentioned COINTELPRO, the counterintelligence program. In their own documents, they say the purpose of this program is not to enforce laws, but to, quote, disrupt, discredit, and neutralize forces. And some of the examples they've used in their documents are like Dr. King or the Women's Liberation Movement. If you were a forceful, effective, charismatic leader, then you were liable to be framed or in some way targeted by this program.
And it's important to point out that there's nothing in the legal code that allows this kind of behavior. If someone has broken a law and they're a member of a group, you find the person who broke the law, you That's arrest right. them. You don't break up the group. There's nothing in the law that allows for that.
That's
and it's sometimes unclear. People think, well, if they're part of a group that does these bad things, go get the group. No, go get the person.
Right.
And so it's important to point out that what they did was illegal. To attack the group itself. James Mays, you talk about something called this business we hear more and more about, prison-based gerrymandering. What is that?
Prison-based gerrymandering is essentially the use of prisons to – the placement of prisons geographically to either dilute or enhance the vote of certain populations. So, for example, you'll find in some communities prisons were brought in to enhance the voting age population. So when they cut the lines, you can – in districts which would – or areas which would not have political representation, they then would be entitled to it because they count the prisoners. And in some other cases, as we saw in Maryland, a prison was placed in a historically African-American community to dilute the vote. So it can go either way. But the point is that it's used to divide the pie to the political advantage of one party or another.
Well, that we're talking now about all the things that happen within our borders. Christina Kauger, your organization, NC Stop Torture Now, advocates for minority groups that are targeted by law enforcement. But one of the main causes is to bring attention to CIA extraordinary rendition, those flights that are launched from an airport in Johnston County. Tell us about that.
Right. Those flights began, as far as we know, in a very systemic way shortly after 9/11. So in late 2001, the CIA began a massive program to sweep up in a kind of global dragnet many, many Muslim men who were either suspected of involvement in terrorism or might know somebody or something. So it was a very loose dragnet, very comprehensive. Aero Contractors, which is based in Johnston County at the Johnston County Airport, has only the CIA as a client, as far as we know. So can be considered essentially an arm of the CIA for practical purposes. And they were pressed into service to transport dozens and dozens of these men from countries in Europe, Africa, or Asia, where they were detained by Allied security forces in the custody of the CIA to other countries. And those countries agreed to interrogate these men secretly using torture and being fed questions from the CIA or the British intelligence services. They were held for months and years incommunicado, no access to judges, lawyers, the Red Cross, their families not knowing where they were, not charged with any crime, not brought before any judge or jury, and then often eventually either freed without charges or transported further to Guantanamo to be held there indefinitely, but in at least a recognized manner.
So for a lot of years, your group has called for an official investigation on the relationship between the CIA and Aero Contractors, headquartered in Smithfield, Johnston County. Earlier this year, the School of Law at UNC Chapel Hill took on that challenge and completed a report. What did they find?
They found that North Carolina has been deeply involved in extraordinary rendition and torture by hosting Aero Contractors, not only in Johnston County at our taxpayer-funded airport there, but also at the Kinston Global Trans Park, which is a state-private consortium economic development project in Lenoir County in Kinston, where there's a larger airstrip that Aero Contractors needed for a business jet, a Boeing business jet, bigger than Johnston County could accommodate, because their business of transporting prisoners and CIA teams to interrogate, to oppress those prisoners and to move them into their detention, they needed the bigger plane. So that's why they started using Kinston. So these activities essentially have been carried out in our names using our public airports. We've been providing all the services airports provide to facilitate this process of enforced disappearance and torture. We think the state should investigate.
What do we know about the legality of this kind of activity?
Well, the United States is a signatory to several major treaties like the Convention Against Torture, the International Covenant for Civil and Political Rights, And those clearly prohibit inhumane treatment and torture. And they clearly require that a state that has engaged in those practices must investigate and must hold accountable those people who designed and ordered and executed the program.
So we've got this report. It talks about a state-operated or a facility in which the state is connected and CIA rendition is taking place. What do we do with the report? What's happened since it's been released?
In January of this year, we met with representatives of the governor and the attorney general and presented the report to them. The report is meticulously documented and is endorsed by three international human rights experts who have investigated extraordinary rendition and torture and have laid out in exhaustive detail how the United States and other countries have been involved. All this information presented to the governor, to the attorney general, there has been absolutely no response. From the beginning, since 2005, when we began calling for an investigation, the response of the governor's office and the attorney general's office has always been, it's someone else's job, not ours. The Johnson County authorities have also uniformly responded, it's somebody else's job, not ours. And the federal government has refused to investigate, and the Obama administration, unfortunately, has taken the position that we will only look forward, we will not look back at any of the abuses carried out in the extraordinary rendition and torture programs.
But it's still going on. It's not like it's in the previous administration.
Well, President Obama, of course, declared that uniformed U.S. personnel would not engage in torture, and that was good. He said he would close Guantanamo, and he hasn't. Mm-hmm. And there have been disturbing reports, especially from Afghanistan, of ongoing extraordinary rendition. The Obama administration convened a task force and explicitly said, yes, we will continue using extraordinary rendition when we think it suits our purposes. There are over 3,100 detainees being held indefinitely at Bagram Air Force Base in Guantanamo right now, and another 50 foreign nationals who have been transported extra-legally to Afghanistan by the U.S. So, yes, it's still going on.
Flint Taylor, let me ask you, what would be the benefit of looking into what has happened out of that airfield in particular? Is there any benefit in knowing precisely what happened, since much of it now is in the past?
Definitely. It's very good work going on in North Carolina. We've been involved in dealing with a systematic police torture ring here in the city of Chicago that went on for two decades and tortured over 100, documented over 100 instances of police torture of African-American men in the station houses here. And we fought these cases for over 25 years, and ultimately we got the main ringleader of the torture indicted and convicted, and now he's a resident of your state at Butner. John Burge, and all of these, this torture issue is connected across the country and across the world in terms of the U.S. Fingerprints on it. Last night, they was mentioned that Romney's talking about Cheney being his vice presidential candidate. Obama and his administration should have and still should prosecute Cheney. He's an admitted torturer. He has admitted that he was involved and ordered waterboarding. Others under the command of Bush are also torturers. The Obama administration cannot and should not look only forward, but should prosecute, investigate, and prosecute, no matter how high it goes. And that includes the rendition issue in North Carolina. That includes Bush, Cheney, and all of those people. And, of course, we do have an example here. We were able to put a ringleader of police torture in the penitentiary for almost five years, but it took a long time. So I think it's instructive and important to link all those struggles nationally, and that the fight against torture is something that cannot, you know, we can't only look forward. We have to look backwards, or otherwise it's going to continue.
James Mays, are they linked? Do you see these cases of extraordinary rendition, what we do overseas, linked to what's happening in our cities as well?
Absolutely. And we can't have it both ways. If our principles that guide us say that that human rights cannot be violated by government, and it includes domestic as well as foreign governments. Look, our Declaration of Independence was very clear. This document was the founding of our American Revolution. And all of the things that we talked about around this table, being imprisoned incommunicado, not having representation in courts, false accusations. I mean, if you just read our Bill of Rights, right, it must apply. And what we see here consistently, right, are people in power, elected officials and appointed officials violating the very principles that we say we stand for. The ends don't justify the means, and we need to be very clear about that.
Louis Pitts, you called this conference last month. What were you hoping would come out of it? What's in it for us as citizens?
Well, let me say there was a lot of help in calling that conference, but I think we're now looking at what I think it was Dick Cheney called a new normal. I'm holding in my hand an article from our Greensboro Record from 2 days ago expressly acknowledging that President Obama selects a list of who's to be assassinated. We've now begun to legalize these very acts that used to be covert. Maybe you'd catch them. So we have to move into the real understanding and meaning that democracy is not a spectator sport. That a self-governing democracy means we may not be guilty of the conduct, but we are responsible. And citizens are beginning to engage. I think Occupy Wall Street is one example of that, and that's what we need more of.
Attorney Louis Pitts, thank you so very much for being with us. Flint Taylor, also with us, civil rights attorney at the People's Law Office in Chicago, peopleslawoffice.com. You can find out more about him. James Mays, director of criminal justice program at the Department of Political Science, criminal justice at North Carolina A&T. Christine Cowager is a longtime volunteer with NC Stop Torture, and then you can find out more about them at ncstoptorturenow.org. Coming up, religion writer Mark Pinsky returns to the show to talk about his latest book and looks at the way people with disabilities are counted out of faith communities. Stay with us on The State of Things.